It hurt like hell, but I had to. I told him not to think about this and to try to keep his head in the game for the time being. He agreed, and we kept talking. I told him that I had seen numerous postings from survivors all over the United States on the internet, but none from our allies overseas. He asked me to read them to him, so I did. I told him that one survivor was in southeast Texas, so that means that he and I weren't the last survivors here. I read about the survivor from New York, and John told me in a distant voice that he had family there. We both went off the air for a couple minutes to get our road atlases. We got back on and started to discuss escape routes should this area become infested and uninhabitable. He suggested the Alamo because it's only a half a day's walk from here. I told him that I thought it would be suicide to enter the city now. I suggested that we borrow a sturdy vehicle and head east to the Gulf of Mexico and find an offshore oil rig. John said that his power had been flickering on and off in the past few days, and he wasn't sure how long it would hold. John had a Honda generator in his basement, but he told me he refused to use it unless he had to, because it might be audible outside. We decided not to waste too much battery power on these two-way radios. I only had three other sets of AAAs. I tried the CB radio on every channel. Only static. I'm hungry. Thought. I still have my XM satellite radio in my vehicle. Satellite equals no lines to catch on fire. If the uplink station is still operational, someone could uplink from the WWW and transmit. I will go out tonight and get the radio and UHF antenna. 23:34 hours. John and I decided that if we needed to talk to one another, we would be at the window at the top of the hour to flash our lights. We decided to make a deal to go to the window and check on each other every hour, until we signaled it was time for bed, five flashes. No light means there is no need to waste our two-way radio batteries. I checked my XM radio. It seems to work fine. Unfortunately, every station that is active is playing a constant loop. Some of the news channels are broadcasting stories and news from last week. Old news. I will continue to monitor when I can. I checked the CB radio again. I could have sworn that I heard the faint signal of a human voice. I called out and tried to get a response. No joy. Looking out the window, I see at least a dozen fires in the distance, and every now and again, I think I hear gunfire. I imagine for a moment that it could be the last survivors in the big city. I bet it is a war zone there. I feel dirty, but I just don't want to waste the water. That reminded me to check the water pressure. Still some left. I haven't left the confines of my domicile for 5 days, I think, sans the bonfire and the slingshot incident. It feels like a month. I wonder how other countries are holding up. I bet Eskimos and some of the small islands in the Philippines aren't really affected by this. Lucky bastards. I wonder if the walking dead are cold to the touch. That would lead me to believe that they don't generate body heat, therefore they are much like a snake. I theorize that if it gets very cold, they may slow down. Tomorrow is Sunday. No church for me tomorrow. I guess he wasn't bullshitting about the Omega part in the Book of Revelations. It's almost midnight, so I'm off to give my five flashes to John. January 19th, 16:39 hours. I woke up this morning to no power. It was around 07:30. At 0800 sharp, I went to the window to signal John. He was already there. He told me that the power went out last night at about 03:30. I slept right through it. I don't know what it is, but I have just been able to sleep a little better since I met John. I guess it's the feeling of not being alone. Being in the military, I never got a chance to make any close friends because I would always be on the move. That was the case here. I had this house built because I thought it would be a good investment and because I knew I would be here for a couple of years. John said that he didn't really need power to do anything. He had a propane cooker and plenty of water. I told him that I was using solar power with deep cycle submarine batteries. My broadband connection is running through the buried cable lines, and it still seems to be unaffected. There is also power to the phone grid because when I pick the phone up, I get the quick busy tone telling me the switchboards are down, but the lines are not out. I told John that I would be back soon and that I had to go to the garage to switch from the power grid to my own power supply. Wouldn't want the power surging back on and damaging my battery banks. After I switched power to solar battery, I got back on the horn with John. He asked me if there were any new survivor entries on the online forums, and I read them to him. People from all over the U.S. were sounding off. Some sounded bleak. Others sounded hopeful. I guess reading the survivor entries to John was sort of an outlet. John and I discussed travel. I told John that I could fly. If I had a way to get an operational aircraft, we could make it pretty much anywhere in the U.S., as long as we had the charts so that I could find airfields with fuel. We were both getting cabin fever, and it showed. We were just thinking of excuses to leave this dead place. 19:20 hours. Gunshots outside. It's too dark to see John's house without the streetlight. I turned my radio on and waited for a few minutes. I was sure John was in danger until I heard him crackle in. "Don't worry, I'm safe. I had to shoot some of them because they were starting to pile up onto each other and form a human ladder." I asked him how they were affected by the shots. He said that he shot 12 of them in the head using only the moonlight at close range and killed them. That's good news. I know that those shots are going to attract more of them, so I will be sleeping extra softly tonight. Suggested to John that he be ready at first light to kill twice as many as he killed today. 23:11 hours. I can't really sleep as I keep thinking about all the people left alive and struggling to survive. A woman in Oklahoma is trapped with her children and asking for advice on the online message boards. What grief it would bring me to find out that my advice doomed someone to being destroyed by a crowd of those things. I know that if I was in a situation, trapped, with the undead increasing in numbers daily around my perimeter, that I would have no choice but to leave. I'm thinking of short-term safe havens as we speak. Water towers, train cars with roof exits. Roofs of buildings with limited roof access come to mind. I just wouldn't want to be somewhere surrounded with no way out. If there are any prisons or military facilities, I might choose those. They are defensible if, and only if, you can clear them out. The more I think about it, the more I realize that my situation could become much like hers quickly if I don't stay in the game. I don't feel it prudent to give others advice, as I am no expert. I just hope that we all survive. There doesn't seem to be much chance for most of them. The Marriage of Figaro. January 20th, 22:23 hours. Situation dire. John and I woke up today and started communicating on the two ways. What I saw out the window was almost too much. It was 0700 hours, and there were approximately 100 of those things on our street, forming a human moat around John's house. I grabbed my carbine, checked its action, holstered my sidearm, and prepared for battle. I donned gloves, hood, and flight suit, and John's radio with earbud. John had no idea that his previous efforts to clear them out would lead to so many following the noise here. I told John to stay put, and I unbarricaded the back door, stepped through, and jumped my fence, avoiding the glass by throwing over an old bath towel. Taking careful aim with my weapon, I started aiming for the nearest ones first, or the ones on the outside of the circle, thinking that this may slow their pursuit down as they trip over their slain. I only had 4 magazines, that is 116 rounds. I shot round after round into the skulls of those things. One would think that it would bring instant death. This was not the case. Even some direct hits didn't hit the brain, but skirted along the outside of the skull only to pass through on the other side. For every 10 I shot, I only killed 8 or 9. The lumbering mass of ghouls chased me as I tripped over the corpse-laden ground. I had no choice. I had to flee. I ran for blocks, only to find more of them. I knew this was a dead place. I could feel it in the air, and the vibrations of their moans hit my chest like a cheap band in a local nightclub. I was being hunted. The nearest immediate shelter I could find was a gas station. My body was full of adrenaline. I knew they would consume me if I gave quarter. I climbed a pipe on the side of the gas station wall and stood flat-footed on the roof. I could tell by the moans and movement in the distance that I was a dead man and lived on borrowed time. I had around 30 rounds left, one magazine and some change, so I decided to take one out of the magazine and save it for myself. I started shooting, trying for headshots, hitting some and missing more. The fog of war was taking my aim, or maybe it was the depression I was feeling, probably similar to someone that just found out they were HIV positive. That is when I heard my savior. I caught glimpse of a car coming from the direction of my street. I kept shooting. The car took notice and headed my direction. It was John. He haphazardly pulled his car around the side of the gas station. There were five of them closing in. I took three of them out before I ran out of rounds. I had to go for my sidearm. I quickly jumped down from the roof, walked up, and killed the last two at point blank, executioner style. A dark brown mist permeated the air behind their skulls. I stayed clear of it, fearing infection, and jumped in the car with John. We skipped shaking hands, and John asked me if I wanted to go home. I told him that if we went back there, it would only lead them to us. He agreed. That was when I came up with the plan. I asked John if he could part with his car. John smiled and said, "What's your plan, sailor?" I told John to keep driving. Those things were following us. I navigated him to a place not far from our homes. I asked John what type of music he had in his car. He was a conservative man. Looking through his CDs, I found what I was looking for. It would be perfect for the job. We made it to the place, a large parking lot next to a run-down factory. We parked the car, and I told him to keep it running. I put a CD in, rolled the windows down, and opened all the doors. I turned everything on, even the wipers. Then I turned the volume up as loud as it would go without blowing the speakers. John and I grabbed our weapons and headed to a safer rally point a quarter of a mile away from his car. The Marriage of Figaro was filling the air of the parking lot and surrounding area. The mass of the undead finally rounded the last corner and came into plain view of the car. Their shambling pace quickened as they saw what their glazed white eyes wanted them to see. They surrounded the car and took it over. John and I wasted no more time. Once we saw that our plan worked, we headed out. On the way home, I told John that I wasn't sure that even they could survive that music. He laughed and we kept moving. We saw a dozen of those things as we made our stealthy way back. None of them detected us. A half a bottle of whiskey later, here I sit, staring at the bullet I saved for myself. Is life worth living? January 21st, 21:43 hours. I have regathered my thoughts and recovered from yesterday's catastrophe and this morning's hangover. John and I have decided that it's better we stay in separate houses because it's never good to put all of your eggs in one basket. We don't want both of us dying because one house is under siege. The events that transpired yesterday really hit me hard. I almost died out there. If John hadn't found me or had chosen not to, I would have spent days up there, dying of dehydration, listening to the moaning of the dead, until I decided to end it. There must have been 500 dead swarming the car when John and I left it there in the parking lot. Last night, lying in my bed, I could hear the faint sound of Mozart in the distance when the wind blew just right. I can't hear it now. I can only imagine how long it took for the car to run out of gas on idle and the battery to drain from everything that I had left on. The streets are clear now, but there is no way to know for how long. When the sound stopped drawing them near the car, I am sure they spread out again. It's only a matter of time until the law of averages puts them back here. John and I talked. Last night, before we left each other to our solitude, after the Figaro incident, John ran inside and handed me a few more packages of batteries for the two-way radio. I could tell he wanted to talk. It wasn't until today that I got around to it. John knew I was messed up. Today I got to know him a little better. John is an engineer, explains his wacky plan with the yoga band. He has a master's in mechanical engineering from Purdue. Told me that he worked for Executech. He expressed his guilt about his son's probable fate, and that he felt like he pressured his son to go to the same college as good old Dad. I told John that it really wouldn't matter where in the world he was when this happened. Apparently, it's just as bad everywhere. After the debacle that I witnessed yesterday, I know that not many would or could survive this. I'm down to 884 rounds of .223 ammunition. I think that anything below 500 is critically low, considering that they probably outnumber me thousands to one, maybe even more. This can't be a battle of attrition, as a Pyrrhic victory is not an option. John and I are meeting tomorrow, providing the street is clear enough. We are going to discuss an exploration attempt and see what type of supplies we can gather. It's quite possible this could be our last few days here. I firmly believe that the government has collapsed. We basically canned the oil rig idea, as it would put us through countless miles of terrain ruled by the dead. When, if we bug out, it's going to have to be both a realistic plan and defensible location. It would be impossible to close off the neighborhood with those things running around. The only thing I could think of would be to somehow drive a few tractor-trailer rigs to each end of the street and use one to pull another trailer over on its side to prevent them from crawling underneath. Then we could use smaller vehicles to fill in the gaps. This plan is lunacy. Before we even put one semi-truck into place, the street would be swarming with them. What I wouldn't give for a seaplane with a full tank of juice right now. I wonder how my base is holding up. I bet the gates are still holding. Worst case, the large planes, 737s, carried survivors to a safe place long before they got in. I need time to brainstorm. Good night, Journal. January 22nd, 22:40 hours. John is here now. We decided it best to plan in person rather than try to coordinate this effort over the two-way. He is in the kitchen feeding his dog. John and I are going to attempt to locate an aircraft suitable for flight. We spent the day packing our essentials, and we are going to head out at first light. John is going to leave his dog in the basement with enough food and water for 5 days. The bonus is she can't be heard if she decides to bark while she is in the basement. I feel sorry for her, but this is no world for man's best friend. While I'm out, I'm going to attempt to locate more weapons. One thing of particular interest that I will be bringing is a car battery jump kit. My car just isn't going to cut it. The plan is to leave in the morning in my car, since John's car is useless to us now, and immediately look for alternate transportation. Any type of military vehicle would be best. An armored car would be optimal, but the chance of that happening is about the same as monkeys flying out of my ass. I am wondering if the GPS satellites are still functioning without human intervention. If we do happen to find an aircraft, I wouldn't mind having GPS as a backup navigation tool. I plan to keep writing in my journal while I am away. I think that we will be back in 3 days, nothing further than 300 miles. We plan on heading to a location near the outskirts of Austin, Texas. We won't be going into the city, especially after my fiasco at the convenience store a couple days ago. I still start shaking and smelling gunpowder and sweat when I think of that. January 23rd, 0600 hours. John and I are off. Change of plans. Back in 2 days, not three. 1000 hours. We departed this morning around 0600. We are currently in Universal City. I packed my car while it was in the garage to avoid any unwanted guests, then turned the ignition over. It sputtered, but started. There is not much room in the Volvo, so our first mission was to find suitable transportation. We made it to the 1604 loop. I have never seen so much chaos. The road was littered with abandoned vehicles. I used my binoculars to survey the area. Panning the binoculars left to right, what I saw was disturbing. Reminded me of the traffic camera I saw before. Seems like weeks ago. Some of those things were trapped inside with seatbelts on. It looked like some left their windows down and were attacked and left to reanimate. We found what we were looking for, although the color wasn't ideal. A canary yellow Hummer H2 was sitting crossways on the loop with the driver's side door open. John and I parked the car out of view, took our weapons and car jump kit, and slowly skirted the knoll near the edge of the 1604 loop. The only movement we could see were a few of them walking around a good distance away, and, of course, the movement of those trapped in the vehicles. As we neared the H2, I saw something that I will never forget. A car seat strapped in the back. I told John to stay put while I approached. I didn't want him to see this, since I know he is or was a father. I opened the back door of the vehicle. There it was. A shell of a human infant, writhing in the seat, reaching for me. The black circles around its eyes looked like orbs. I wanted to cry as I unfastened the seat and set it on the ground, a safe distance away. Just as I sat the car seat down and bent back up, I saw her. A woman, badly disfigured, wearing a pair of jeans and a t-shirt and boots, was slowly moving about not more than a few meters up the road. She caught glimpse of me and started walking toward me. A high, shrill moan escaped her decomposing frame. I desperately tried to figure out a way to quietly dispose of her. I knew we were going to have to jump the Hummer, causing noise, because the driver's side door had probably been open for days, if not weeks, leaving the dome light on. She approached slowly and steadily. I looked inside the Hummer. There was a pillow in the passenger seat. I quickly grabbed the pillow, took off my belt, and wrapped the pillow around the muzzle of my Car 15, fastening it tightly with the belt. She was on me, so I had no choice but to fire. Just as her gnarling lips curled over her yellow teeth, I pulled the trigger on my carbine. The weapon made no more noise than popping corn as the monster's head exploded in a dark mist behind her. She was no more. I knelt down to the small infant. I sat there and meditated over what had to be done. I prayed that if there were a God, I would be forgiven. I dispatched the young one with my knife. No further details about that need to be given. After the previous encounter, I threw the pillowcase over the car seat and signaled John to come over. I didn't see any immediate threat in the area. Sans one of them in the car 20 feet away thrashing about. John brought the portable jumper, basically a charged battery with cables to connect to dead battery. I unfastened the hood restraints, leaned in the driver's door and popped the hood, and went back into the car to check for keys. No keys. I sat there and reasoned for a minute. What happened to the driver of this vehicle? Would he/she be so selfish as to leave their infant to die here at the whim of those things? After careful thought, I realized that maybe the parents didn't leave the infant. Checking the interior of the vehicle, I noticed a pink pine tree air freshener hanging from the rearview mirror. Then I looked down on the ground at the ghoul thing that I had just killed. I checked her pockets and found the keys to the H2, as well as her driver's license. Sorry about your baby, Ms. Rogers. I took the keys and tried to turn over the ignition, just as I thought. Dead. I took the portable jumper and hooked it up while John turned the key. She roared to life, checked the gas. It was running off fumes. John jumped in the passenger seat, and we were off. We did sort of a U-turn and drove back in the direction of my car. On the way up the embankment, I looked in the rearview mirror, and I could tell instantly that we had gained some unwanted attention. I would guess a score of them were lumbering toward our vehicle about 300 yards off. I stopped the Hummer next to my car and quickly loaded the supplies into the back of our new vehicle. We then headed to the nearest location that we could get fuel. John and I knew that the pumps would not work without electricity, so we brought part of a garden hose to siphon the gasoline. After about 2 miles of driving and weaving in and out of wrecked traffic, I spotted a side road and took it. We drove for a half a mile before we found a car that was old enough to probably not have a anti-siphoning screen. Its hazard lights were blinking dimly, probably been flashing for weeks. We checked the perimeter and didn't see any threat. I parked the H2 in a position that would make siphoning easier. We drained every drop from the car, but this only put us at half a tank. It would have to do, as the gas stations are all closed. Blue Light Special, Aisle 13. 22:43 hours. If there was a hell on Earth, I found it today. I am thinking about just throwing my camera away, as I don't think anyone would ever want to see these images, even if mankind somehow survived this ordeal. All I see are images of death and destruction. I drove most of the way. After we left Universal City, we headed up I-35 toward San Marcos, dodging in and out of cars and those fucking pus sacks. It is taking its toll on me. I have a newfound respect for combat veterans that saw death every day. I don't see how they did it. I could see the smoke over Austin well before we even got to San Marcos. We needed gas, so I took exit 190 and veered off, taking a right into a long abandoned Walmart parking lot. John kept a lookout while I relieved myself in the ditch. I did the same for him. We pulled the Hummer near some cars so we could siphon more needed gas. At least this time we found a late 80s model Chevy Blazer that had a full tank. We filled the Hummer up to over 3/4 full. I was sitting somewhere around 880 rounds of .223 and 300 rounds of 9mm. John had two bricks of .22. I approached John and asked him if he felt like doing a little shopping. The door was locked when we got to the front. I went back to the Hummer to pull it up front and check the toolkit for a pry bar. I found what I was looking for and commenced to try and pry the door from its lock. I got good leverage and put my back into it. John was watching the parking lot to make sure we didn't have any surprises. I kept tugging. All of a sudden, I felt a thud on the door. I looked up, and much to my chagrin, there he was. A corpse in a bloody blue Walmart vest pawing at the glass door, trying to get out. The thing walked right into the door and bumped into the door latch on the inside. The door came open slightly as the thing tried to ease itself out to us. It poked its head out, and I took that opportunity to drive my tire tool into its head through the eye socket, killing it instantly. I held the door open like a gentleman and let the corpse fall out onto the sidewalk. I opened the door fully and placed the trash can there to keep it open. I told John that I thought that there were probably more inside. We pulled the Hummer so close to the entrance that no one could get in, and no one could get out unless they went in the driver's side door and climbed out the passenger door. It was my idea in the event some visitors decided to show up during our shopping spree. I showed John how to handle his weapon inside closed quarters conditions. I call it the Recon Glide, as I had picked it up from one of my Marine friends. John and I eased through the aisles. God damn it. Why does Walmart always have to put sporting goods in the back? I motioned to John to look where I was looking. It was another worker that must have been killed during a shift. It slowly walked toward us. I gave John the signal to shoot, because his weapon is much quieter than mine. With a careful aim, John took the creature out, and it lay lifeless on the floor. Thank God for the skylights, because without them, this idea could kiss my ass. John and I continued to the back. We made it to sporting goods and found that many of the guns were either sold out or looted. There were many boxes of .223 ammo, and also many boxes of 12-gauge shells. There was one gun of particular interest left in the cases, a Remington 870 12-gauge pump. I saw fit to break the glass and give it to John, since he was lacking in the firepower department. We took the shells and rounds for the carbine and started to make our escape. John and I were constantly scanning the aisles for ghouls. Just as I rounded the corner from sporting goods, I was pulled off my feet by a female corpse. I hit the ground hard and felt a tug at my ankle. I felt a hard pinch as the thing tried to bite me through the heel of my combat boots. I gave her a hard kick to the nose and heard the cartilage snap as I hit home. I got up and stepped back, checking my heel for wounds. Thank goodness for Ultima boots. She didn't get up, as her back had been broken by a large shelf that had fallen on her probably weeks before. She snarled at me. John took aim. I signaled him not to shoot. I walked up to her and brought my heel down upon her temple as hard as I could. She was no longer a factor. We made it to the front, and, just as I thought, a welcoming committee was there to greet us. I stood and counted 30 of them. John climbed through the window over the driver's seat, and I did the same and sat driver. I started the ignition and rolled up my window. We would have been in a pickle if we hadn't wedged the H2 inches from the open door to the store. As we pulled out into the parking lot, I lost all care and just mowed them over. John was busy pulling the stickers and tags off his new Remington. It was time to find shelter, as the sun was starting to get low. We got on the service road along I-35 North and started to look for a spot to stay. I recommended to John that we find a semi-safe spot and just sleep in the Hummer. He agreed and joked, "The Motel 6 isn't exactly open anyway." I kept driving until we reached a small town called Kyle, just south of Austin. There was a sign that read, "Kyle, Texas, welcome home." That was when I noticed the spot. There was a large hayfield with a fence around it, and no sign of any of those things shambling around. I pulled into the drive and picked up the T-handle that held the gate in place, motioned John to switch seats and pull through so I could secure the gate again. We pulled the Hummer in between four round bales of hay. The bales covered up the sides of the vehicle so that if anything approached, it would have to do so from the front or the back. John and I made sure all doors were locked, and John went to sleep. It's 23:30 now, so I suppose I should do the same. January 24th, 15:34 hours. John and I awoke at 06:15 this morning to the sound of a rooster crow in the distance. I started the H2 up and pulled out from between the hay. We pulled over to the gate and looked down the road from the direction that we came. There were a lot of them in the distance. Couldn't tell if they were heading our way. Could it be possible that they heard our vehicle and were following the sound this far? I hope not. We arrived at the outskirts of Austin, Texas, at 07:05. The smoke was almost unbearable. Visibility was only at around 100 yards. Every now and again, when the wind would blow just right, I could catch a glimpse of the taller buildings in the distance. One of them looked like a torch, as its tip was burning brightly. To the right, I could see what looked like an airport air traffic control tower. John and I took the next road to the right toward the tower. We made it to the outer perimeter fence. It was a small private airport with a few Cessna aircraft and two small jets sitting inside open hangars. A section of the fence was destroyed, so we drove right up onto the tarmac. We surveyed the area and didn't see any immediate danger. I tied off a rope to the front nose wheel of one of the Cessna 172s, picked out the best-looking one, and opened the cockpit door. To my surprise, sitting in the passenger seat, I found the aircraft pilot's kneeboard, flight computer, and chart. I climbed in the cockpit and yelled at John to take it slow and easy and to pull us over to the refueling station. I shut the door and concentrated on the checklist, so that I could turn the aircraft's electrical system on and check the gauges for fuel or anything out of the ordinary. Every few seconds, I felt the aircraft tug as John towed the aircraft and I to the pumps. After checking the gauges, I was happy to find that both wing tanks were full, so I opened up the door, jumped out, and ran ahead to tell John to flip a bitch and pull the bird back to the tower. At the tower, I used the aircraft checklist to do a walk-around inspection. I didn't fancy the idea of losing my engine over a heavily infested area. I prepped the bird for flight and discussed with John our next plan of action. We took out our Atlas and looked for the nearest airport to our homes back in San Antonio. I looked and looked, and all I could find was the international airport in the center of the city. That was unacceptable. John bent down and had a puzzled look on his face. He asked me if I had ever been to the Retama Park racetrack off of I-35. He told me we passed it on our way out of town. I had never heard of it since I hadn't lived there long. John asked how much length I needed to land the plane. I went out to the cockpit and looked in the chart compartment. I couldn't find any info. Some of the smaller planes I have flown needed maybe 1,000 feet if I used beta. This bird didn't have beta controls. I had to take a guess. I would probably need 1,500 feet minimum. John said that he thought it might work. John and I brought our weapons up and carefully approached the tower entry doors. John opened the door and I took point. The elevator was obviously out, so we had to take the stairs. We shut and latched the door behind us as we quietly ascended. There were windows at the top of every flight overlooking the runway. I heard and saw nothing until we got to the top of the stairs. I saw a coagulated pool of blood sitting in front of the tower control center door. I motioned for John to look. I walked up to the door slowly, opened it, and jumped in, ready to blast. I didn't expect this. One of the controllers had taken out four of those things, and then, probably out of despair, had turned his pistol on himself and did the same. I opened the doors to the observation deck, and John and I threw the bodies over the side, opposite the side the aircraft was on. John and I went back downstairs to unload the H-2. We brought everything into the tower just to be careful. I locked up the Hummer and went upstairs to plan. John expressed to me that he would not leave his dog in the basement to starve to death. I understood. John told me that he would take the H-2 and meet me at the racetrack, and then we would both go to the house in the H-2 together. I would have to fly the bird and land safely at the track. I had many hours in military aircraft, but never in a Cessna. It was going to be risky, but necessary. I calculated that it would only take me around 35 minutes to do the startup checklist, get airborne, and be over the track. This meant that in order to conserve fuel, John was going to have to leave before I did. It was a 2-hour trip for him. I showed John my calculations, and he agreed it would be best he leave first. 22:43 hours. Dark outside. Only fires can be seen in the distance. Found some airport departure approach plates for this airstrip. It was a good thing, too. Because of the documents, I found out that there is a water tower 200 feet high off the departure end of the runway. I would never have seen it in time with all the smoke. Now at least I know what general direction to fly when I get off the ground. It's time for sleep now. January 25th, 0700 hours. It was time to fly the coop, literally. John and I went outside this morning and looked down at the base of the tower. Apparently, we had made too much noise. There were 10 of them walking around the tower, bumping into it, making metal tapping sounds. I distracted them as John threw the non-breakable supplies to the ground so that we would not have to make multiple trips. John came over to me and handed me his .22. I told him I would take care of them while he consolidated the supplies. Visibility was still only around 100 yards. I shot the creatures and quickly helped John with the last of the supplies. We made it down the stairs without incident. I took what I needed for the flight, i.e., my guns, some food and water, and left John with the rest. I asked John if he were sure. He said yes. I told him I would meet him at the track at 0930 hours. Last night we took a portable radio from the tower, so John could reach me on 121.5 when we needed to talk. It was the aviation distress frequency. Doubt anyone would mind. John got in the Hummer and drove off. I got in the aircraft and locked the doors and started checking everything I could for the weight. All the smoke in the air and poor visibility must be fucking their senses up. I figured that those gunshots would have attracted more. I am getting scared, and I am leaving now. 0812 hours. I'm in the air now. The aircraft is trimmed up so I can go hands-free, and I am headed back to the track. Decided to do a little recon mission since I was in the air so early. This plane is relatively easy to fly. I thought it would be more trouble than this. After taking off, I decided to head toward the base and see if the walls were still intact. I remembered the VOR frequency, dialed it into the navigation aid, and followed the needle. My heart sank as I descended through the clouds at 2,000 feet. I flew right over the base, as low as I could, and saw the horror. Every building was either on fire or destroyed. Looked like an airstrike. That might explain what happened to Austin, Texas. I pulled the aircraft around into a shallow 15-degree angle of bank and headed toward the gate. The gate was totally destroyed, and through the smoke, I could see thousands of walking dead dominating the landscape inside the base. I then brought the bird on general course to make rendezvous the track. 23:56 hours. I am home. I don't feel like writing. The dead are the lucky ones. Hindsight is 20/20. January 26th, 1842 hours. Yesterday was a hard day. I made it to the track with plenty of fuel to spare. The fence was intact and there were no creatures present. Looked like I was going to have enough room to land, but noticed that the track was uneven and it looked like about a 10-degree grade. I was going to have to show some good aileron control to keep both wheels solid when I landed. I came over the northern end of the track at 85 knots, pulled back power, flared, touched the back two wheels, eased the elevator control, and brought the nose down. Pulled power back to idle, and let her roll to a stop, no brakes, since the track was dirt. Looked down at my kneeboard and flipped the pages to the engine shutdown checklist. I shut her down after I taxied her to a less visible spot on the back end of the track. Now came the waiting game. It was 09:30 when I sat down. I didn't see the H2 anywhere, and it would be difficult to miss a canary yellow H2 even at 2 miles visibility. If John came, he would see the bird and know I was near. I decided to try and find something to cover the plane up with so it would be less noticeable to anyone, living or dead. This was a racetrack, so I was sure there is some type of tarp somewhere. I took my rifle and headed for the maintenance area. Outside the chain-link fence of the track, there were numerous undead walking around. Some of them were rapping on the fence, angry at their inability to walk through it. I know that if enough of them came, they would do just that. I approached the maintenance area with caution. I stood in front of the steel door and listened. I could hear the sound of banging metal. Sounded like someone was using a hammer on the floor inside. My philosophy has always been stealth over confrontation. I walked around the building looking for windows. I found one in the rear, about 8 feet off the ground. The only problem was that there was a corpse shambling about on the opposite side of the fence. It couldn't get to me, but I concluded that it would make a lot of noise if it saw me. Window was a no-go. I quietly hugged the wall back to the door. The sound had stopped. This was really fucking with my head. I couldn't take it anymore, so I eased the door open and looked inside. It was dark, except for the spear of light shining in through the window that I had seen. I could smell rotting flesh. I shut the door again. My instincts told me, fuck the plane cover, it's not that important. For some reason, I ignored that completely logical thought process. I took out my LED light and tightened it on the light mount of my rifle. I switched the light on and opened the door again. Put the muzzle of my weapon in so that I could light up the dark garage. The smell was almost unbearable. The source of the noise became immediately apparent. A dead mechanic, crushed by a hydraulic lift, was lying there on his back, reanimated, and banging a torque wrench on the ground. A low grunt came from his badly mutilated body as he tried to look up at me. He was reaching for me. It was then, all in the span of a second, that the following happened. I saw the bite marks of the flesh that had been torn away on his face and neck. I knew that he didn't do it to himself, and deduced that there was another dead fucking corpse in the room. Last but not least, the door flew open, and I was tackled by one of them. Best guess, the same one that had the mechanic for lunch. The only thing that was keeping this stink-ridden shitball from biting my nose off was the fact that I had my weapon wedged between us. I pushed it off, and it, couldn't tell male or female, grabbed my wrist. I gave it a nice rifle butt to the head, and it fell back. I immediately got to my feet and popped around in its miserable head. I wanted to just fucking mow it in half, but the reasonable half of me kicked in, and I told myself not to waste the ammunition. The door to the garage was shut, and it was going to fucking stay that way. I could hear the sound of fists on the door, and I knew that there were more inside. I went back on the side of the garage where I saw some oil drums and rolled one of them back around to the front, to put in the doorway and prevent whatever was behind that door from opening it and ruining my day. No more exploring. I carefully started walking back toward the plane. I noticed that I had gathered an entourage of fans on the other side of the fence. I guess they enjoyed my little execution. They were gnashing their teeth on the metal wire and groaning and beating on the chain-link fence. Watching this motley crew of gray evil made me very uneasy. About that time, I heard a vehicle approaching. I hid behind one of the concession stands and watched. The ugly yellow confirmed my suspicions. It was John. I ran up to the gate to let him in. It was locked. Reluctantly, I pulled the carbine up to fire, aiming for the part that touched the chain and not the actual lock. 3 rounds, and the lock fell off the chain. I was thinking to myself that shooting locks only worked in movies as I yanked the chain off and pulled the gate open. John came screaming through. I quickly shut the gate, wrapped the chain back around the gate, and ran over to the aircraft. I remembered seeing a C-clamp in the cockpit, clamped to a headset. I quickly unscrewed it and ran back toward the gate. There were a few of them already within a rock throw. I put the C-clamp through both ends of the chain and tightened it down. Wouldn't stop a living person, but I doubt these miserable shells of human beings could figure it out. I walked back over to the plane where John was parked. I looked at him. His cheek was bleeding. I asked him what happened. He told me that he had to make a stop to siphon some gas and ended up having to shoot 3 of those dead people. He killed the first one, and on the second shot, he missed, and the round ricocheted off a concrete embankment, hitting him in the cheek. He killed the last one and got the fuck out of there. Luckily, he was finishing up the siphoning when this happened. When I first saw him, I thought he had been bitten or scratched, and my only friend in the world was going to be one of them. I told John that I probably had about 2 hours worth of fuel left, roughly 190 nautical miles at max cruise speed of 95 knots. The plane was ready to fly. John and I decided it best to leave the plane and head home to figure things out from there. We were only maybe a 20-minute drive from home. I collected my things out of the plane and put them in the Hummer. We were going to have to distract those things if we were going to get back out the way John drove in. I walked over to the gate and got their attention. I used myself as bait. They were on the other side of the fence, and lured them to follow me while John got ready to make the escape in the Hummer. They followed me to the other end of the fence. This gave me 200 yards to sprint back, open the gate, get in, drive through, get out, and shut the gate back. No problem. It went exactly like that. John and I drove toward our home, dodging, surviving. This was becoming second nature. John took a back seat when we got to my neighborhood and parked the vehicle in an empty building lot. We took our weapons and essentials and made like shadows back to John's. We avoided being seen by a few of those things along the way. We jumped John's wall and he rushed in to check on his dog, and I secured the rest of his house. His dog came running upstairs, jumping up on John and licking his face. I told John that since I had power, he should use my house as a base. After all, if we're going to die, might as well be together. It's funny how attitudes change. Today, we spent moving John's gear over here, one trip at a time, avoiding being seen. I had a feeling we would be taking to the air sometime in the nearer future. January 27th, 1713 hours. I'm glad John is an engineer. He thought of a way to make an alarm device that could save us in a pinch. We thought of it today when we had to go out and quietly put down one of them that was beating loudly on my back gate. I killed it with an ice pick taped to a metal pipe with duct tape. It was then that John asked me what I thought of his plan. He wanted to wire a battery-powered radio to the mailbox of a house 2 doors down. He said that he had quite a bit of wire in his basement and that it would work. We slipped over to his house to gather some supplies and the wire. His basement was full of Annabelle dung. We took his battery-powered alarm clock radio and the wire, and a simple light switch that we cannibalized from his house, and made a sort of remote alarm. Our thinking was that if those things got the jump on us in the night, and there were too many of them, we could flip the switch, turn on the radio, and use the noise to draw them to the mailbox across the street and a few doors down. John wired it so that the radio alarm would sit inside the mailbox, thus using the metal box as an amplifier. We tried it out for a second, and it was definitely loud enough, although we had to use the alarm function, as there were no more stations broadcasting. We wrapped the wire around the pillar of the box and tucked it along the curb out of sight. The problem came when we had to get it across the street and into my wall for easy access. We brought the wire across the street, and John and I took shovels and piled dirt over it so that those things would have a hard time tripping over it and yanking the connection loose. All in all, it was over 100 yards of wire. I mounted the light switch for the alarm to a junction box using a kitchen magnet. I will be spending most of the night figuring out where to go next. We might end up staying here for a while, but then again, the mood I was in yesterday might take over. After our little invention was complete, I used my binoculars to check on the Hummer. From my vantage point, I could only see from the side view mirrors to the front. I could see 3 to 4 of them curiously wandering around it. I made sure to take a mental note of this. January 28th, 2039 hours. While monitoring the citizen band today, I made a startling discovery. I intercepted a recording being transmitted out on CB Channel 9 for survivor volunteers to be members of the New Military. The broadcast was a recorded loop dated yesterday. The recording was calling for responses at the top of every hour. Something didn't sound right. If this was a band of leftover military and they were calling out for replacements, what happened to the original members? Slain? Executed? No chances. I turned it off until about 10 minutes shy of 1800 hours. Then I listened in for any others out there that might volunteer. Static.
Shane Stahl here, Concord, Texas. Anyone there?
Yes, this is Captain Thomas Beverly, formerly of the 24th Special Tactics Squadron. It's good to hear your voice.
The conversation went on, and the two exchanged information and decided upon an extraction point not far from Shane's house, near the water tower off the interstate. John and I discussed this new development and decided it was best to continue monitoring and gathering information until it could be discerned that this rogue group was in fact a benign group of leftover volunteers. Spent much of this morning reading over the aircraft manuals and emergency procedures. I wanted to be knowledgeable of this aircraft's systems the next time I took her up, just in case. John and I discussed numerous destinations for our next outing. We had one of two options. Continue to stay here and hope we don't get overrun. Or take the bird and what we can fit inside and head southeast to the islands off the coast of Corpus Christi. There is a naval air station on Corpus, and I'm sure there is plenty of fuel and maybe even a better aircraft. If we chose the bug-out option, careful consideration would have to be given as to what equipment stays and what goes with us in the plane. John and I have a combined weight of 360 pounds. Add fuel and luggage to that, and we can only afford to fly with 400 pounds of supplies. That was also pushing it, and that wasn't much when you added it all up. We began to make a list of things we absolutely could not leave. John listed dog, 20 pounds. I told John not to worry. Annabelle was coming with us. We wouldn't be leaving today, or tomorrow for that matter. I told John that I did not wish to die on my birthday. January 29th, 12:50 hours. A group of bikers came roaring through our neighborhood 30 minutes ago. John had to put the muzzle on Annabelle to keep her from barking. I doubt they would hear the bark over the roar of their engines, but my motto is no chances. I counted 70 to 80 bikes as the convoy rolled past. Many bikes had passengers. Most bikes had long rifle shotgun holsters mounted on them, complete with weapon. I noticed something that I didn't think you would have seen before this epidemic. There weren't just cruisers. There were also racing bikes, crotch rockets, in the convoy. I bet they used the racers as recon scouts. Again, this group looked rough, and I didn't see it necessary to alert them of our presence. 1847 hours. The sound of moaning, shuffling dead is almost unbearable. 3 hours after the bike convoy came through, the creatures that were no doubt following them began their slow parade into the neighborhood. John and I are maintaining our silence. In the fading light, there are too many of them to count. This could easily turn into the worst-case scenario. I do not think that they are alerted to our presence, but I cannot be sure. I can see them periodically looking in this direction and walking into my wall. but I do not know if they are trying to get in because of the noise. I went to my gun cabinet and pulled out two sets of yellow foam earplugs and handed one to John. I told him that if we had to make a break for it tomorrow, we were going to need our rest. John stuck them in his pocket and nodded. 22:13 hours. We got our things ready just in case we had to make the great escape. Many of the ghouls have continued on their path in the direction of the bikers. Many more undead are seemingly lost and confused and have camped out here on our street, just walking around, bumping each other, and changing directions. It reminds me of my college physics class years ago. The molecules were bumping into each other in unpredictable patterns and just milling about on the slide. I would say a safe estimate puts the count at 85 walking dead. I can only go off the moon and starlight for my estimations. If today were a normal day, my fellow squadron officers and I would be getting shit-faced at a random bar on the Riverwalk. It was my birthday, and I know they wouldn't allow me to stay inside like this. Well, I guess the celebration would have to wait. I had a shot of whiskey with John and toasted to survival. Good night. Note to self. Find some NVG's most Ricky Tick. Proverbial Beans. January 30th, 1534 hours. Bad news. While monitoring the television and radio, John and I came across the first government broadcast in weeks. It was being transmitted over every available TV channel as well as over the AM bands. I think this might be because AM carries further than FM. It was the First Lady. In a solemn voice, she relayed to what was left of the United States that the President had perished in an undead attack and died a week earlier. The armed forces were now in control of the Vice President. She went on to say that the VP was in a secure location and that she hoped for the best for America and the world. She warned of rogue military factions that had deserted over the past weeks and hoped that they would come to their senses and return to fight for their fallen commander-in-chief. She saved the best for last. She asked that anyone able to hear the following announcement to do their best to spread the word, as she was sure that not many survivors had electricity or access to a TV or radio. She then spilled the proverbial beans.
The President has authorized the use of tactical nuclear warheads on all major cities. On February the 1st, at approximately 10 a.m. Central Standard Time, a strike force consisting of joint Navy-Air Force bombers will deploy high-yield tactical nuclear warheads on major urban centers. We believe that this retaliation strike will give us the advantage we so desperately need to take back our country and eventually our world. The use of our Global Hawk and Predator UAV drones has revealed major populations of the undead in and around the targeted cities. If you are able to travel and you can hear this message, I urge you to make preparations to evacuate. We will now broadcast the list of designated target areas. Please look closely at the bottom of the television screen.
I could now see tears rolling down her face. Nope. She wasn't bullshitting. They were going to do it. I watched and crossed my fingers. I knew my city was the eighth largest in the United States. I didn't kid myself. As the letter R cities rolled by, John and I held our breath. There it was. San Antonio. John and I have been designated as a nuclear target. I live 18 miles from the Alamo. The Alamo is the center of San Antonio. The blast radius would be at least 20 miles, depending on the warhead. I bet they weren't taking any chances, meaning the blast radius would probably be more like 50 miles. The instant that thought crossed my mind, I watched as the doomed cities rolled by on the bottom of the screen. A precautionary tutorial was being displayed. Minimum safe distance is 150 miles from ground zero. This would mean that the government is using their mountain buster nukes and are pulling all the stops. I looked over at John and said, I think it is time we thought about leaving this place. January 31st, 2341 hours. Situation is not improving. John and I loaded up the Hummer for our trip to the racetrack. We will be flying out tonight. The moon is out, so visibility will be great for flying. The text on the emergency broadcast is warning survivors that bombers will be dropping electronic sound decoys.